Hello, everyone, and welcome to Celebrating Cinema, a podcast for the love of cinema. While I have your attention, it would be great if you could leave us a review. It really helps other film lovers find us. Sex and the City might not exactly be cinema, but there's a lot to say about the four cosmopolitan friends from New York. Hugo recently watched the show and the universally hated movies for the first time and is going to sit down with longtime fan Kiriko to talk all things Carrie, Miranda, Charlotte, and Samantha. Here's Hugo and Kiriko.
Hugo, hello.
Hey, it's been a while.
Welcome back.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
It's really been a while.
Yes, we're so back.
You're so back. I have been here for so long, but you're so back.
We're so back.
I want to ask you if you've watched anything beautiful lately.
Well, actually, yes. I'm recently doing a deep dive again in the works of Adam Curtis, a British documentary journalist who works for the BBC, who makes a lot of these like super intense kaleidoscopic political documentaries about how a thing that happened in the 1950s in Saudi Arabia has, you know, inspired the events of 9/11 and so forth, like huge political things. He recently made a new series called Shifty, which is on the BBC, which is about Margaret Thatcher's era in England and how her like form of neoliberal economy has completely taken society out of whack and what that means and what it looks like and how it inspires artists to kind of rebel against this, but also how society just seems to slip out of control. So it's about the past.
Wow.
But maybe it's also about the present and the future. Who knows?
Probably.
Yes.
It always is, isn't
it? It's very engrossing. I'm quite addicted to it right now. Yeah.
Nice.
And how about you? What are you watching lately?
I saw last week, I went to see Joshua Oppenheimer's first fiction film. And he previously, of course, made one of the greatest documentaries that has ever been made,
The Act of Killing.
Mm-hmm. And now he endeavored into fiction. It's a film called The End, which is a story about the last family existing on Earth once Earth is not livable anymore, with a beautiful role of Tilda Swinton. It's a musical. It is one of the worst things I've ever seen in my life.
A post-apocalyptic musical with Tilda Swinton.
It was a really beautiful experience to watch it because also, I think you've also once said this, that it's somewhat sometimes also really nice to see something horrible that you hate. And it's also a very comforting thought that someone who can make something extremely beautiful can make something extremely horrible as well. I think that is
bad things are just as generative as great things, I would say, for sure.
That's so true. Yeah. Talking about bad and great things.
Yes. What a segue. Thank you, Kiriko. Yeah, we'll be talking about Sex and the City and the Sex and the City films and about
and, not
and just
about,
like that.
Yeah, exactly.
Today.
Also about And Just Like That.
Yes, which I'm extremely excited about. And I prepared a little cold open. And for full disclosure, this cold open is based on an article that I recently wrote for Little White Lies about Sex and the City 2, a film from 2010 that I got quite obsessed with because it is bad. Maybe it's even awful. But in that sense, I would say the film is also genius. So I'll try to convey that a bit in this cold open and then we'll dive into a fantastic universe that I beforehand was a complete stranger to and now I'm completely obsessed with.
Yes, please.
This year, I finally immersed myself into the glamorous world of Sex and the City. A utopian parallel dimension based on the writing of Candace Bushnell, in which a weekly sex and dating column in the fictional The New York Star affords Carrie Bradshaw, of course Sarah Jessica Parker in her defining role, a seemingly infinite amount of Manola Blahniks, boozy brunches, and a gorgeous rent-controlled brownstone apartment on Manhattan's coveted Upper East Side. I immediately became obsessed with the trials and tribulations of Carrie and her friends Charlotte, Miranda, and Samantha. My heart ached for the impossible love triangle Carrie finds herself in between Wall Street enigma Mr. Big and hippie adjacent loser Aiden. I drew inspiration from Charlotte's pursuit of the perfect marriage. I thrived on the sexual escapades of the fearless cougar Samantha. And as a freelance writer, I deeply related to the professional ordeals of Miranda. Perhaps surprisingly, my boundless admiration for these characters also extends to their most outrageous adventures in their second big screen outing, Sex and the City 2, a film from 2010. A film also so universally derided that its harshest reviews have become more iconic than the botched movie in itself. As Linda West penned in her ultimate takedown, and I quote, Sex in the City 2 takes everything that I hold dear as a woman and as a human and rapes it to death with a stiletto that costs more than my car. That's a fair point. And as the third and last season of the Long in the Tooth spin-off series And Just Like That reaches its own shit-stained finale, if you know, you know, I decided to write a big piece for Little White Lies about how the direness of Sex in the City 2 is in fact maybe genius. A piece in which I try to honor the hilarious, exhilarating, and at times baffling journey that is traversing the Sex in the City verse. And that's why we are here now, to discuss what is arguably the greatest TV show on earth, to share our admiration for Carrie and company, and to explore the strange theatrical releases and spin-off series that have spawned out of this magnum opus of glitter and glamour. Which immediately, Kiriko, raises the question, what is your relationship to Sex in the City?
Sex in the City is one of the most important things in my life. I think about Sex in the City at least once a day. And
this is
I
your
think
Roman Empire.
This is absolutely 100% my Roman Empire. I think about Sex in the City very often. And I think I'm really not the only one. I have a lot of friends with whom I speak in Sex and the City language, or I really use the series sometimes as a way to understand life. And I think that has a lot to do with how the series also tries to categorize life in a very simple and sometimes also superficial way, but always true to life. I think it really highlights the honesty of superficiality of life and also the beauty of aspiring certain forms of superficiality in a way that does not happen a lot.
And take me back a bit. How old were you when you watched Sex in the City for the first time, and on how many rewatches are you already? Because I know many people that have seen this series need not once, but twice or thrice, but many, many times, right?
Yes, definitely. I think I started watching Sex in the City around the age of 17, 18. And I started rewatching a lot when I moved to Italy. When I was 18, I moved to Italy. And my way of learning Italian was buying all six seasons on DVD, which were all dubbed in Italian.
Fantastic.
And I knew all the lines of all the girls. So I would hear it in Italian, know what they would say. And then that would be my way of learning Italian. And that's when I watched it really on loop. And it was the beginning of when I was in Italy. So I had no friends. I just had Sex in the City. And then it became, yeah, my foundation. And I think I rewatched it once a year.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
You know, you have to imagine that as a straight guy, that very often, you know, in life, you will encounter moments where people talk about Sex in the City, but that you don't really have a lot to chip into the conversation.
Do you, as a straight guy, often have...
Inadvertently, you will be in conversations with people that find it, again, the greatest TV show on earth, and that will, you know, ask each other in company when you need new people. Are you a Carrie? Are you a Miranda? We'll get to there as well, of course.
Yes.
But somehow it was never a thing that I watched. And then last year with my girlfriend, we were talking about it, and she is an avid Sex in the City watcher. She's already on like 7 rewatches or something. So I said, I've never seen it. And she was shocked. How in your entire life, I'm 32 now, have you never seen Sex in the City? We'll start now.
Yes.
And I'm so insanely grateful. What an incredible gift it was, because we started watching and I became almost more obsessed than her. And, you know, this is why I find it so interesting that you say that it's such a comforting series, because suddenly I realized something incredibly important, that Sex in the City in this, let's say, secular, a-religious world has become somewhat of a Bible.
Mm.
It's a guidebook, a handbook that can give you some pointers as how to live life.
In New York, they say you're always looking for a job, a boyfriend, or an apartment.
I've been dating since I was 15. I'm exhausted. Where is he?
Who, the White Knight?
Sometimes it's hard to walk in a single woman's shoes. That's why we need really special ones to make the walk a little more fun. Have you ever been in love?
Absolutely.
What it did for me was a couple of things. First of all, it immersed me in a world of frank conversations between very fascinating, multifaceted women that are so open that it gave me an exceptional insight in the psyche of the opposite sex. And not to talk too much in binaries, but this was just simply all of these cultural touchstones and references I never had access to.
Yeah.
And now I find myself in funny situations because whenever I can talk with new people about things that they like, and it is, of course, quite, female-coded, or it's very, let's say, gendered, who is the main audience that is being catered in Sex in the City,
mm-hmm.
which I also want to completely dispel because I think the entire population should watch Sex in the City.
I agree.
Period. But whenever I am in a conversation with other people that identify as non-male or also as non-straight, then I can often raise the notion, and what do you guys think of Sex in the City? And we immediately have a deep chat. It really feels like I've also unlocked a skeleton key of small talk.
Mm.
And then that small talk leads to pretty big insights about other people.
Mm-mm-mm.
Because, and now I'll ask you the question as well. Mm. You can immediately ask, are you a Carrie? Are you a Miranda? Are you a Samantha? Or are you a Charlotte?
Mm.
So Kiriko.
I think I'm a Miranda. But I think essentially everyone is always a Carrie, but would not like to admit it.
Yes, because canonically, Carrie is the protagonist of the series, and I would say that she has an incredibly rich and fascinating interiority, but she's also just such an insanely insecure and messy bitch.
Yes.
She makes so many awful choices in her romantic life, in her professional life, in the way that she treats her friends, in the way that she presents herself.
Yeah, she's a horrible person. And I think as you grow older, when I watched this for the first time, I didn't realize this at all. But as you grow older, you see more and more of her flaws and you hate her more and more. And also you start understanding that every time you hate her, you have been her in some moment in your own personal life, which I think comes back to what you were saying about how it is a religion in and of itself, because it's in that way really one of the greatest mirrors that you can hold up to yourself.
We basically have the apostles right here.
We do. Yes. I wonder, as a guy, have you been asked this question?
If yes. You're,
because I can also imagine that because it is such a binary series, that it could be also fun to ask which guy in the series you identify with, because there's so many more to choose from also.
Well, let me start, and I also forgive us to the listeners that are not, completely immersed in this universe yet, but this is also your invitation to join us on this
Please.
Journey. But I'm a big Mr. Big guy
I see that.
For a simple reason that I just love the way that he's this hunky, enigmatic Wall Street banker guy. And I'm not a Wall Street banker guy. And I also wouldn't particularly describe me always as enigmatic. But there's something in the way that he presents himself and that he wants things out of life and he kind of knows how to get it that I find, at least he's my aspirational guy. And then I also have to admit that occasionally there will be moments where I watch Aiden, who's my nightmare. I hate Aiden so much because he's this he's this hipster adjacent loser who just kind of stumbles into Carrie's life and he pulls out the worst out of Carrie, and I find him so insanely great, and I think he's kind of a social negative. And then sometimes I see him do something and I'm like, oh, I remember I did this and this time. And I'm like, no, this is too much like Aiden. Mm. So yeah, it's again, it gives you some handles on life, right? And if I would have to identify myself with the women, I find that I am somewhere between Charlotte, Samantha, and Miranda, in the sense that I think I want Charlotte's kind of like very grounded life, the building, things on the horizon, to have a nice relationship, to have the nice home, to do all of these things.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also Miranda because she's the anxious professional who's like, I am a single mom and I'm a lawyer and I have to do all of these things by myself.
Mm-hmm.
This stress I know, of course, very much as well. And then Samantha has this laissez-faire, let's enjoy life and be good at it as well and get the thing also again that I want, which is fun, which is sex, which is having a nice time. I deeply aspire to this too. They're all my guides in life now, which is insane. Because again, you know, a year ago, I didn't know any of these women. And now I'm constantly, just like you, thinking about them.
Can you guys explain something for me?
Yes.
I've never seen Sex in the City.
Shame.
Maybe if this podcast goes well, I might dip my toes in it. But let's say in film and cinema, we tend to celebrate characters that are not so binary, right? That are more gray because we think it's a more honest depiction of who we are as human beings, or we can relate to that more. But it seems here in this TV series, they're playing caricatures or very sort of like flattened maybe identities. And there seems to be a greater connection to these different characters in a way that perhaps at least I'm not used to feeling a connection in cinema. So how does it relate, or what is it about these characters that
I can answer it also by immediately making the move that we should make to contextualize these series a bit more, and then also move on to the films and the TV series that came after it, and just like that, which is that obviously, Sex in the City is very much a product of its time. We are talking about an HBO series that at the beginning of the 2000s, when HBO was kind of like really becoming the hallmark of prestige and quality television with very multi-layered, complicated characters. I'm talking The Wire, I'm talking Tony Soprano, of course, in The Sopranos, etc. This series has remarkably walked the line between the old TV, where you have sitcom kind of like comedy situations where people are very easily identifiable, and is more what we call now prestige TV. And it constantly traverses back and forth a bit between these two modes, to the point that the episodes itself can play out like a sitcom, because there will be an overarching kind of like maybe sub-theme or kind of like big joke with a big payoff at the end that will happen. And all of these characters you know, so you kind of know how they will respond to certain uncomfortable social situations of what it's like to navigate life in the elite circles of Manhattan. But simultaneously, there is this development in the plot where a lot of very, very deep and important things happen. Huge relationship crises, divorces, people getting sick, people cheating, falling in love with other people, precarity of maintaining a lifestyle in Manhattan, and so forth and so forth. So you have an artificial world that acknowledges all the problems of the real world, and you have very real and, let's say, very pressing existential stories about what it means to be, in most of the cases of these ladies, somewhat middle-aged or approaching middle-aged single woman in New York that is on the dating market but is completely exhausted by what it means to meet new people. And then you have all of these artificialities again slipping in into these real narratives. And this dynamic, this push and pull between these two, you could call them extremes, are so incredibly complementary in this series. And I was completely taken aback because some of these episodes,
it's beautiful writing,
are stunning.
Yeah.
And also never forget that at the beginning of the series, it looks amazing
because it's shot
on film, of course, because that's the era, but it's shot on location. They spent so much money to be on actual Manhattan locations. This is where, in some cases, most of the budget would go to be in an actual restaurant, to be on the actual corner of Fifth Avenue. To be in the actual stores where they buy all of their designer bags and designer shoes. So you have this artifice and again this realism constantly intermingling.
And I think to add on to that, I think one of the most beautiful things, and eventually also the downfall of Sex and the City, is that it's completely apolitical. All the pain and the problems and also the pleasure of what these women go through have absolutely nothing to do with politics, because of course they're elite women who dabble in money and never really have a real problem to struggle about.
It's utopia. They live in utopia.
And then of course that is also the criticism that the series later received, so then they try to make it completely political, but we'll talk about that in a minute. And I think therefore the problems that they talk about, because they are not political, are still very fundamental, because the series is about sex, but then it is really mostly about only sex. So there's a whole series, or sorry, a whole episode that you talk about why you're not able to talk with your partner or flirt about not wanting to give a blowjob. And then you talk about it for 25 minutes in a most fundamental, open, beautiful way. And that is the main issue that you talk about.
Exactly. It's like, you know, the adagium that it's like everything is about sex in life, money, work, power, all of these things, except sex itself. The sex is also always about something else, right? And this series knows this very well, and also knows that everything around it is basically window dressing for all of these existential conversations. And by the virtue of it being somewhat apolitical, because they live in this nice bubble of Manhattan, it's a recurring joke that they don't want to leave Manhattan. And there's a couple of episodes where they have to leave Manhattan because they go on a girls' trip to like Atlantic City or to LA or this and that. And things always go awry in the classic sitcom goes on holiday episodes. Things always go wrong and they want to escape as soon as possible back to Manhattan, right? Mm-hmm. But by virtue of basically pushing everything that is too much or that is unnecessary out of the series, it has become incredibly timeless as well. And again, here we see an interesting irony, because if you look at the early Sex in the City episodes that were so... And never forget, this is also mostly due to Sarah Jessica Parker, who was a fashion icon, who was very much locked in the cultural and fashion scene of Manhattan in the 90s and continuing onwards, of course, also in the 2000s. They were always right on the mark what the cultural zeitgeist in this moment was.
They
made the script. But there's a new podcast series by the actress Kristen Davis, who plays Charlotte in the series. The podcast is called Are You a Charlotte? And she interviews a lot of the people that were involved in making the series. And she goes episode by episode through the entire series. And then she will invite new people for a new episode to talk about, well, what was your experience? And how did you work on this episode? Et cetera, et cetera. And then she's talking with one of the screenwriters for about the first season. And they say, like, when we were making this series and we were writing the script and we were shooting it, we felt like we were ahead of the time, and then it would launch on HBO, it would premiere. And then some of the things that we would kind of sign towards, that we would, you know, put on the table as a conversation piece, like some uncomfortable sex things or as a fashion phenomenon or whatever, anything that might happen, people would start to copy it. It would manifest itself in Manhattan. So for a pointed moment of time, yeah, they were making the script. They were the zeitgeist. They were before the zeitgeist, which is absolutely incredible if you think about the cultural impact that this text, this Bible, has made, which also justifies that we're talking about it now, because it has influenced so many things afterwards. It has influenced a lot of indie filmmakers. It has influenced, of course, Lena Dunham, who with a series like Girls has made a series about young women who have watched Sex in the City, basically, and are trying to figure out their lives for themselves.
Want
to have the Carrie Bradshaw life, but it doesn't look quite like that in reality, right? So it's been incredibly influential, but now we're talking about it also from the perspective of hindsight. We're looking at it from the rear view mirror, because in the last year, we've had the final seasons and final episodes of And Just Like That, the spin-off series in which all the ladies are even older. We're talking Sarah Jessica Parker in her 60s plus onwards.
Mm-hmm.
And we have the two films, which is what triggered my piece. And I would love to talk about it a bit more. Okay, let's put it very bluntly. The first film was very important to capitalize on the success. And it's a very, let's say, important film because it does something that we have discussed very often in this podcast. It capitalizes on IP, on these franchises that are too big to fail. And then you can basically make a semi-soulless cash grab and you know that people are going to run to the box office to go watch the film. It was a success, of course. Then we have the second film.
When did this come out? Do you know?
The first film was 2008. Mm-hmm. The second film is in 2010. And this film, the first one people kind of like because they do something smart. The first film is basically, if you would condense the narratives of an entire season, all of these big romantic relationships that are developing or that are digressing, and you condense it within the framework of 2 hours. Mm-hmm. Sex in the City 2 did the opposite. They took the idea, what if we basically have one episode, like for instance, the girls going on a road trip, and we make it a 2.5 hour film.
I think we need some glamour.
1 week in Abu Dhabi, all expenses paid for all four of us. Get out of town.
My point exactly. I can hear the decadence calling.
Ooh. I don't think we're in Kansas anymore.
It's insanely long. It's very strange. It looks somewhat disgusting because it has a very strange hybrid of celluloid cinematography and very weird digital post-production. It's a remarkable film to watch. But then it expands this what is essentially a very loose narrative into 2.5 hours.
Summarize what happens in this film.
Yeah, so my entire thesis that I have wrote is that Sex in the City 2, first and foremost, is the most ultimate time capsule, again, of its era, but maybe against its own wit. The people are not in control anymore, like they were with the early seasons, about what is the zeitgeist. But it is almost a soulless copy, a simulacrum of what was happening in that time. And that makes it an honest representation of life in 2010. Mm. The idea for the film started that the financial crash happened in 2008, which of course had a huge impact on people's lives in New York, which is where a lot of this financial crisis stems from. Mm-hmm. Wall Street collapse in 2008. So the writer and director, alongside Sarah Jessica Parker, was thinking, we need to go back to opulence, to splendor, to glitter, and to glamour. And how best to do it? With more beautiful dresses, more designer clothes, and a big trip to what would be the new global beacon of capitalism, Abu Dhabi. So the girls go on a road trip to Abu Dhabi. Samantha, our favorite cougar who works in PR, she's asked by a sheikh to represent a new luxury spa resort or that he's opening in Abu Dhabi or that's already there. They're flying all the girls in private jet. They're all getting picked up by their own individual Maybach car, including their own driver, this and that, to the hotels. They all have their own palatial suite rooms in the hotel. They're getting pampered. But then, of course, things go wrong, very wrong. But then it takes 1.5 hours for the things to go wrong and the girls are in Abu Dhabi. And at some point, you're literally losing your mind because you're looking at it and you're thinking, this used to be the greatest TV show on earth. Why am I watching this absolute piece of shit?
And now that I think about it, actually, absolutely nothing goes wrong, right?
Well,
from the beginning to end.
Samantha is too horny for the Middle East, so she gets basically arrested all the time and she gets like shamed by people. They fuck up the deal with the sheikh, then they have to leave the hotel and they are almost settled with the entire bill. Suddenly they can't fly private class back to Manhattan anymore. So maybe they have to rush back to the airport with the retour tickets that they still have.
That's what I'm saying. Nothing otherwise, goes wrong.
Otherwise they have to fly economy. Can you imagine? Can you imagine Carrie Bradshaw, who should always be shoe shopping because she's a queen. She shouldn't be thinking about economy class. She shouldn't sit next to us, ordinary people, who are even struggling to pay the ticket to go to Abu Dhabi. Absolutely not. This is a huge crisis. So it becomes this kind of like mirage. It becomes whipped air, as they say. You know, nothing really is happening, but we've taken a lot of screen time to show all of these things. And then I was thinking, what an interesting film that we have all of these strange projections of America on the Middle East, first and foremost as this capitalist heaven, Abu Dhabi as the new place to be. But then also, it is one of the most racist, strange, orientalist projections of the Middle East. There are so many awful jokes about the repression of women, about how everybody just basically looks down on them, how everything there is way back and very much from the past. There's this inherent tension in the film that for me is also a perfect example of the American imperial mindset, right? The way that they look at the Middle East at this point.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking this film is awful, but what a rich text again it is. So you see my obsession with this series and with these ladies. It has no bounds. I can suffer this film many, many times and still enjoy it so much.
First of all, thank you for giving me really the most lovely description of this film I will ever hear in my life. I've put this film in a deep, dark past of my own, because I think for a lot of people who are so deeply connected to Sex and the City, this is such a shameful
It was piece. A travesty. It was really a travesty.
I really put it away somewhere where I cannot go back to it, because it's as you said, one of the most racist things that have ever existed. And it's also, but in that sense, it feels so miserably at all the things that the series used to be good at. Because so a large element of this film is also menopause, right?
Yes.
Which I think
Samantha is approaching menopause and she's delaying it.
She gets hot flashes.
Yeah, she's getting hot flashes and she's trying to delay it, because again, Samantha is canonically permanently horny. She can always fuck, and she fucks a lot of handsome people in the series and of course also in the films. She's trying all of these supplements. She has like 50 different creams on the flight with her, which also get confiscated, because why is she having all these suspicious powders and oils and this and that? But she's trying to postpone menopause and delay aging, basically. Yeah.
And I think this on itself is already, it's quite a beautiful idea to make a film about menopause or women approaching menopause and what that could imply. And I think, still to this day, it's not really something I have seen ever since.
Exactly.
Maybe it is still the only film that explicitly tells about the struggles of menopause. So in that sense, it's actually quite odd that it makes us hate women in menopause in a profound way.
It makes you just, this film makes you hate women almost. You can easily become a misogynist because of it. And Elliot's point, or Elliot's question is very well deserved, because here you see what goes wrong is that these beloved characters that have the tendency to become cardboard, but they never did in the series, because they were always fascinating and always had some surprise up their sleeve. They were always more than just the sum of their parts, suddenly become caricatures of themselves. And for so many people, this was, of course, a painful, painful disappointment. For me, again, it results in a lot of almost, let's say, political analysis. What is going wrong here?
Do you have a favorite moment in the film that you think for you really sort of concentrates what this film does for you, or at least how it becomes this capsule of this moment in time in America?
Well, it's like I said, how it tries to fight basically the Depression era by throwing all of this wealth on the screen, and then how it actually fails to show what it gives them, and what it actually takes away is their friendship, which I find very interesting. Because what you can say a lot about these women, and they're very different. They make very different choices in life. But in the series, they are always friends. They are always good friends. And then in this film, they are in their own cars. They're in their own hotel rooms. They're completely isolated from each other. It's like they're atomized. And they get in fights constantly, and they are pissing each other off. Like they are on the souch, on the like spice market. And Charlotte wants to buy a souvenir for a lovely family, because her, you know, her lovely husband is at home and the kids and this and that. But then,
and the nanny has boobs that are too big.
Yes, so. And but then because she wants to buy souvenirs, they get late maybe to catch the plane to get their, you know, private jet back home. So everybody's pissed at Charlotte, and then Samantha is too horny and she gets arrested, and then everybody's pissed at Samantha. And then Gary, of course, meets Aiden, which if you're invested in the series is a super traumatic moment, because you're like, no, not him, he's back again. This is the beginning of the end, because she's going to make all of these stupid choices. And lo and behold, she goes to see him in the hotel room and suddenly, or in the hotel lobby, and suddenly she's not vibing with her lady friends anymore. So this like female solidarity that's a through line through the entire series is also destroyed here. And then you think about late-stage capitalism and you're like, isn't the construct of solidarity also constantly under threat in the age of individualist capitalism where we have to maintain our social economic position in society? Maybe yes. So it's like you can do this kind of Marxist read of this film and it will hold up so incredibly well.
To continue where you left off, I think what you're saying is so right. There, this scene in the souk is really one of the most chaotic. It's so chaotic. And so what happens is everyone's stressed, lost, and they do get saved by what we could call their Abu Dhabi community.
Yes.
Which is a group of women dressed in burqas who say, yes, who sort of wink them to a sort of narrow airy alleyway where they then come together at their book club. And then one of the most magical things happen, which is all the women with the burqas take their veils off. And there we see that they're actually dressed in Prada and Louis Vuitton.
They have designer lingerie. Yeah. They're just like the ladies.
They're just like us.
Yes.
Isn't it so beautiful that capitalism also flourishes here, but under the veil?
Can you imagine that these backwards Arabs in Abu Dhabi actually can afford to have Prada? Isn't it insane? Shouldn't they all be like the men slaves that work in their hotel that pour them literally hot milk in the middle of the night because they're just constantly at the service of these ladies? Isn't it insane? No, it's absolutely fantastic. It's I was laughing my ass off during this scene. It's,
yeah.
And it says so much about this like naive projection of Americans on the Middle East. And I like, again, Edward Said, you know, the quintessential scholar who has wrote the book about Orientalism, he would have a field day with this film. You can just yes, you can screen it in a university class and dissect it, and you know exactly what Orientalism
yeah,
is.
Yeah, yeah,
there
yeah.
is a moment where they are on camelback going through the Sahara. Never forget also that this film is actually not shot in Abu Dhabi because they wanted to shoot there, but they figured actually this place is maybe a little bit too scary to shoot at. So they shot in around Marrakesh in Morocco. So they have scenes in the desert, which is the Sahara, which is absolutely not Abu Dhabi's desert. So you have iconic Sahara scenes literally shot on the same location as Lawrence of Arabia, and they're on camelback. And Samantha is bragging about a guy that she has fucked the night before, and she calls him the Lawrence of my labia. This is the level of screenwriting that's going
that's
on here.
Beautiful.
So you have a reference to one of the big titles, big epics of film history, and you again can shit on this as well.
From here on, things really go to shit, right? Because this movie gets heavily criticized yes, for all things
like
that
I said,
it's wrong
takes
for.
Takes everything that I hold dear as a woman and a human and rapes it to death with a stiletto that I can't afford.
It really does that. And as great as Sarah Jessica Parker and what's the director's name?
Michael Patrick King
are, they take this criticism extremely
too hard.
Seriously.
Yes, they take it too hard.
They take
yes,
it too hard. They really try to do their best to make it everything that it has never been, which is, and just like that.
Ooh, and don't even get me started on just like that.
Sorry, just to clarify. So they made Did they? How many seasons of Sex and the City are there?
There are six seasons of six.
Did they
Sex
make
in the City.
Six and then two the movies. Second film?
Yeah.
So the films came after.
Yeah.
The,
yes. Yeah. This is also never forget. This is actually a good point, Elliot. Never forget that for a lot of people that saw this film in the cinemas, they thought that this would be the end of the Sex and the City universe. Because also behind the scenes, there was a lot of reports of beef between Sarah Jessica Parker and the actress that plays Samantha.
Kim Cattrall.
Kim Cattrall. So it was already kind of pointing towards the idea that Sex and the City 2 would be the foul aftertaste that this cinematic universe would leave behind.
And also nothing lasts as long as this has been lasting. Because mind you, the first series aired in 1994, 5, I think. And this film is 2010.
And then
and
just
we
like
are
that,
in 25.
And just like that came in 2016-ish, the first sort of 2020, I don't know.
2020 because it's 21 because it's the masks and everything. It starts with masks, yeah.
So yes, for the longest time people think this is the end. And then they go back to the writing room and they decide we have one more series in us. It's called And Just Like That. It's a continuation of the Sex and the City universe in which, again, like I said, the ladies have grown older, which is super interesting. And mm-hmm. I like it a lot that you can actually have these characters and grow along with them. And you can also see, again, just like menopause, things about what it means to age as a woman. In the case of Carrie, sometimes also still a single woman, what that looks like at older age. But this series is so insanely demented. No, honestly, it's one of the strangest things I've ever seen. It's like... Yeah. At times it approaches a Lynchian quality in the sense that scenes just don't make sense.
Yes.
It's nightmarish sometimes what's happening. And to contextualize it for our dear listeners, what happens is a couple of things. Like Kiriko was implying, they double down on the critiques of it being, you know, Orientalist, racist. They make it woke. They make it, like, performatively woke. You have, like, Samantha's daughter becoming non-binary. You have Carrie, our dear friend, has become a podcaster, just like us. And she's...
Miranda is a lesbian.
Miranda is a lesbian. And Carrie is podcasting with Shay Diaz, a non-binary comedian who falls in love with Miranda. And all of these strange choices are being made. And they constantly make this point. Like, look at us. We're doing the diversity and inclusivity thing. Yeah. With capital D and capital I. Aren't we being very good kids?
It's not Sex in the City. It's sexuality in the city.
And what they... Exactly. And what they forget is how to make a nice scene. So scenes just kind of... Okay, in Sex in the City, you would just have a conversation like this. They would be sitting somewhere for brunch. They would have some dialogue, some jokes about sex, about work, about life. Samantha would make a snappy joke. Everybody would laugh. They would be drinking their, you know, martinis or whatever. And you're done. Next scene. Things would flow. Things would be snappy. Things would be juicy and tasty. And in Just Like That, things just kind of get elongated to the point that you think, am I watching slow cinema? What is going on here? It's absolutely strange. And this for me is so if... And I'm wondering what you think of this, Kiriko. If Sex in the City 2 is the time capsule of Obama era, in which America is like half confused between everything sucks, but we still try to keep the party going, right? We still need to pretend that we're rich, that things are going well. We have a strange relationship with the Middle East. Maybe it's great, maybe it's not. Never forget that Obama is the drone president. He loved the Middle East for very nefarious reasons. But it was a nice place for him to visit with his American pals. And then here we have a series which is, for me, the ultimate Biden era. It's geriatric and demented as fuck. Things take too long. People can't say goodbye. They can't let go. We're kind of stuck in situations that we don't want to find ourselves in. We are repeating things of the past, but suddenly they don't make sense anymore. We are watching Joe Biden incarnate in the Sex and the City universe. Honestly.
Because they're also old and forgetful and
trying
to be cool.
They're old and forgetful and they're still trying to be cool and they're trying to resurrect things that worked in the past. But to be honest, they're not really working anymore. It's not really making sense.
That's true. But I think one thing that I like about this series is that it takes this idea of caricature. And I'm not saying that the four protagonists are caricatures, but what happens in Sex and the City, the original series, is that all their dates and all the men that they date are all caricatures of themselves.
Yeah, yeah.
And
it's one of the funniest guys. I'm sorry to interrupt, but and this one made me wince a little bit as well because I'm into music and I have a record collection. There's the jazz guy. There's like Carrie at some point is fucking a jazz guy and she's in his house and she wants to have sex and he's like, oh, have you heard of this record? Yeah, it's Mac Roach on drums and it's like, oh my God, this is like a John Coltrane solo. And he's showing her a record collection and he's just like this big infantile idiot kid who knows too much about jazz. And I'm just sitting there, I'm like, I've been this person, you know, I like Jesus fucking Christ. But yeah, it's good.
Beautiful because it really allows you in a way to make caricatures of your own life as well. Or I think that is something that a lot of people do, you know, when you're single and you're dating people, you mark people that you've dated as like, oh my God, that one weird guy or girl who you deduce them to one thing.
Yeah.
And that's, I think,
it's good.
Beautiful.
It's healthy.
It's very healthy. But the funny thing is that now they've done the same principle in And Just Like That, but then with race and sexuality.
Yeah.
So,
like, we have a black woman, and she's doing
all these black things, and like, but it's all cool. It's all
and
nice.
Never forget,
and
it's also it's the assistant of Carrie, who's the black lady. It's
she's from Louisiana.
She goes back to Louisiana, and then she gets a nice fashion back for herself as well because she wants to be just like Carrie.
She deserves one. Yeah.
Yeah. This is so true. Yeah. And then, just to illustrate how some of these scenes just don't make any sense anymore. And I'm talking, we're at the end of the series now, already in season 3. We know that this is also probably going to be, again, the final season and that we have to say goodbye to these characters. You think there's a lot of narrative arcs that need to be resolved. Carrie is, you know, struggling with the fact that she's single again after Mr. Big. Something has happened with him. And maybe something else happened as well in some other relationship. There's all of these big things that need to be resolved. And then you think, okay, now time is of the essence. We need some really economic storytelling towards the final episodes to wrap this all together. And then we're in the school auditorium because Charlotte's daughter is doing a school performance, which is already like the not even a B plot, it's a C plot. And then we're in the aula of the school auditorium. Charlotte shows up with a guy called Mark, who plays a role later in the series, but he's a completely insignificant character. She steps into the frame, approaches all of the other people that are there, and she's like, guess who I found? Guess who I dragged in? And it's Mark. And you're looking at him, and then they're having a chat, and I'm like, why is Mark in this scene? I don't give a fuck about Mark. Mark is like a guy that I forgot 5 episodes ago. And suddenly we're given like precious minutes to Mark. Like, and just everybody is also just standing there. Again, like Joe Biden, almost not knowing how to react. Just like being froze. And this is genius to me. Like, how dare you to make these kind of choices at such a critical moment in the storytelling, in the dramaturgy of the series. Again, everything sounds like it fucking sucks, and to be honest, it does. But this is also what makes it so fascinating. I love it because it sucks.
Yeah.
You've said before how the TV show is a time capsule, or the film itself represents a particular moment in time, but from this conversation, it feels more like it maps the trajectory of not only America, but sort of liberalism in America, mm-hmm. and the mindset of it, of how like in the 2000s, it saw itself as super democratic, super accepting and free and individual and all these things. And then in 2010s, it's having a sort of reckoning with that. And the 2020s are sort of like the consequence of having to live with that. Because it seems quite clear that
this is a perfect thesis. This is literally what it is. Mm. And in the beginning, they are so fluid in navigating the social fabric of Manhattan. And they take such great pleasure out of it. And again, it really is utopia. They have not a single worry in the world, except for the fact that they, you know, want more fulfillment in sex, in romance, in marriage, in this and in work. But these are like secondary concerns because everything else seems to be going quite great, right? you're just enjoying the ride. And yeah, exactly. Then at some point, things stop making sense and they kind of cave in from the inside. And then now we're at this point where they feel out of whack as well. They're out of touch with the younger generation, with the people around them. The friendship is under threat as well. So yes, it's in that sense, again, a super honest reflection of the political trajectory of a lot of people, of like a baby boomer generation as well.
It's interesting you said it's the original TV series is apolitical, and yet the series and structure of the show itself can't escape politics, mm-hmm. and it's forced to confront it in a way. Mm-hmm. And I think that's quite clear of what's happening in perhaps society, right? That we've avoided politics for so long and now it's coming in on us.
Like a boomerang.
Yeah. And I think it's also, it's really a way of speaking that I really recognize with a lot of baby boomers who are truly like from a very genuine place, trying to comprehend all of the things that are going on. And maybe really, I mean, trying to understand what it's like to have a non-binary child or whatnot. It's a real struggle that it's depicted in really the least honest, the least, yeah.
But in all of its artificiality, for me, lies its honesty, because the series has such an ineptness with dealing, and I'm talking in just like that, of dealing with all of these changes in the social fabric, that again, it becomes an honest reflection of the world at large, because it's like things also don't make sense for a lot of people. Things are kind of like out of whack. Mm. Things are a little bit broken on the inside, just like this series, just like these characters. And then you try to hold on to the good old times and you try the best. And this is what we've talked about so much, this nostalgia bait that is kind of constantly coming at us, because it comes from a time in which we thought things did make sense. Yeah. This is why we love Jurassic Park, or why we love this or that. And this series is kind of doing the throwbacks, but then also they don't work anymore.
I wonder, is there any other film or franchise series that has lasted for as long or as longer than this?
I think the only equivalent would be like soap operas, just like television soaps in various countries. Like we have in the Netherlands, like Good Times, Bad Times, Goede Tijden, Slechte Tijden, which has been running for such a long time.
There's another sitcom in America called It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, which has probably gone on for maybe almost 20 years. And it also, it's a different way. It's much more satirical and takes the politics of its time and flips it on its head.
Yes.
How bizarre.
And it's very astute. It's actually very cleverly written, which is also ironic that this is like very dumbly written, and both of them are honest reflections of their time.
Yeah.
But yeah, it makes me like, okay, so you've done the foray into And Just Like That as well. I'm very curious, because you're a longtime fan, right? It's like, has it... And I've seen all of it in rapid continuation, so for me it just all becomes enmeshed. But has it changed your relationship with the core text, with Sex and the City, the series? How do you perceive that?
I think my relationship is mostly only with Sex and the City, because that is what drew me to it originally. And I don't look at it in this context that you're describing. It's fun to reflect upon it in this way, but that is not personal. You know what I mean?
Yeah, you're on the meta. You're not with the thing itself.
Whereas Sex and the City is extremely personal. So that will always only be the text to come back to. But still, I wonder what will happen when I myself have reached the age of 50. And I am in menopause, and maybe that will be the moment that I will go back to Abu Dhabi. And maybe then I realize that there is a newfound truth and honesty in there that I hadn't realized myself, that the chaos that film is also the chaos that time period of your life represents.
Wow,
who knows?
That's super deep. That's super nice.
Yeah, I would love to come back at this table and talk with you about it at that moment in time.
Talk to you in a couple of decades. And yeah, it's like to end on a certain note, what I genuinely also hope is that, and I know Sarah Jessica Parker wants to continue because it's basically not funded by Max anymore. It's not even HBO anymore. This is also an interesting aspect of the degradation of this cultural text. And just like that, it's not HBO, it's Max of HBO Max, you know?
Yeah.
So it's already the other service and not the premium one.
Yeah.
So she's in talks. She's trying to scheme if she can prolong the series through some other means.
Yes.
Oh. And I would love to basically see these characters die of old age. I would love to see them in even more geriatric situations. I would love to see one of them having dementia or this and that. This would be genuinely super interesting if we see the life and death of Carrie Bradshaw and her friends.
It's like, have any of you ever read John Irving novels? He's like this writer who describes the life of a person from the moment that their mother is born to the moment that their child dies.
Yes, exactly.
And it's really beautiful to understand life like that from the beginning and the end, which we never do.
And we need this. We need this with Carrie Bradshaw. I think even if it's all going to be shit, people are still going to watch for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
Because they love the characters.
Yeah,
these characters are great.
Yeah.
How can you not watch?
Yeah.
And even if it's a train wreck, a car crash in slow motion, we'll still watch and we'll discuss it even more, right? And I will write another demented text about, well, this says a lot about the fifth Trump era that we're in. And
I'm curious, Elliot, are you convinced to now watch, embark on this journey?
Yes. I mean, more for the sort of historical trajectory that I want to see it go on, but perhaps I end up finding a more personal connection.
But that's how
connection.
They get you.
Yeah, exactly.
You'll get in out of sense of curiosity, and then you're hooked. Just
I can
like
let
me.
You know which of the four women I identify with in probably a couple
me
of
neither.
Episodes.
Me neither, I can't
time.
Wait.
Stay connected with us at Celebrating Cinema and Lab by following at Lab111 on Instagram and Letterboxd. If you love what we do, support us by leaving a review on your favorite podcast platform. It really helps us climb the ranks of the podcast charts. This was a Lab111 production, edited and produced by Elliot Bloom, with music from Hugo Emmertzahl and artwork from Studio FFF.